Thank you all for coming. My name is Carol Simmons, and I am from Yellow Springs Friends Meeting, and I'm on the Planning Committee. And every year, yearly meeting, we invite a couple or an individual to speak to us as our living witness. The living witness is those who have lived a life that is a witness to their faith and to their Quaker values. This year, we are welcoming Dr. Carl Hyde from Yellow Springs. And part of Carl's life witness, we feel, has been his family. And so with him, joining him today, is his son, Dr. David Hyde, and his daughter-in-law, Susan Hyde, who's in the back there. And I believe there are other family members here, too. Sarah, here in front, and Martha from FMC. So I'm going to let them do the storytelling, but I did want to share just a little of my experience of Carl as a deeply caring person that I've known then in attending Yellow Springs Friends for 25 years, and the examples that he's shown as just his deep caring, and perhaps it's that caring that led him to become a doctor to begin with, but he continues to show it in so many different ways, both large and small. And a small example for me, which was significant to me, a couple weeks ago, our meeting had some discussions about how we might better support and welcome LGBTQ people within our meeting. Not hearing me anymore. You still hear me? Okay. Which was an issue that was very personal to me, personal and emotional. After the meeting, Carl sought me out and asked me how I felt, how what I thought of the discussion and how I was feeling. And just that example of caring meant just so much to me. And those come out in just ways over and over again. I was going to share that little thank you. We're going to enter into a little silence, some centering silence, and Carl then will speak out of the silence.
Thank you for coming, friends. And tell me if I'm getting this microphone to the right place. Is that about right?
Okay.
I'm glad to be here. In fact, at my age, I'm glad to be anywhere. And I should tell you, that line is not original. I got it from Douglas Steer, who used it when he started to talk in 1977. But I do thank the scheduling folks for inviting me to speak about my history. My relationship to the Society of Friends is unique, as I'm sure is true of everyone here. I have to say that I was by no means a birthright Quaker. In fact, I was really essentially raised as a heathen. I was growing up in rural New Jersey while my parents were nominal members of a congregational church in Palo Alto. Needless to say, that church membership had no meaning for me. In high school, I decided I wanted to sing. So I walked to the neighborhood church, which happened to be Methodist, and asked to sing in the choir. And they were delighted to have me, and I enjoyed that fellowship. I did the same thing on several co-op jobs. When I was at Antioch, I'd go to the local church and invite myself to sing in the choir. My first connection with friends came at the end of my college time at Antioch because I wanted very much, before going into medical school, to have an experience abroad. And I knew that the friends had work camps in Europe. So I got in touch with them and spent a week at Pendle Hill in preparation. And that was really my first experience of Quaker meetings. The service committee accepted me and set me up with a work camp in Hildesheim under the auspices of the Swedish Work Camp Organization. Swedish Work Camp Organization has a reciprocal arrangement with the AFSC, so they were sharing our responsibility. I took a student ship, which was a converted wartime troop ship in 1948, spent a week in Paris, and then took a train to Hildesheim, where my work camp was located. Hildesheim had been a medieval wooden city. The Allies bombed it in one night with firebombs and completely destroyed the city. We were constructing a youth hostel using scrap material from the area. I can remember spending a lot of time cleaning old mortar off bricks. I came home by another student ship. This one was not a converted troop ship, but a prestigious vessel of the Holland America Line. And they were out to convince us that we should come back and use the Holland America Line whenever we went somewhere. Because you understand, this is before anybody thought about flying across the Atlantic. So how did I get to friends? After this work camp experience, I got to medical school in Cleveland, and I joined a fraternity house in Cleveland near the medical school. And then I found that a block away from the fraternity house was the Cleveland Friends Meeting. So it didn't take me long to join the Cleveland Friends Meeting. But let me back up a little bit here, because there's another episode that I want to share with you. Before I graduated from Antioch, I had heard that there was a man in New York using Gandhian techniques to deal with racism. Well, I was interested in the issue of race relations. In fact, it began when I was in high school in Columbus. I belonged to what was called the High Y, which was the high school branch of the YMCA. I invited my friend Howard Lewis to join with me. Well, Howard Lewis happened to be black, and this created quite a crisis because there had never been a black person in this particular chapter, and they refused to admit him. So I had to resign my membership in protest. I don't know what finally happened to that. I'm sure it's integrated by now. But I then went on to Antioch. And at that time, at Antioch, there were no black students. I joined an organization of students, which we called the Race Relations Committee, which was concerned with trying to get some color in the student body. And among other things, we met with Jesse Treichler. Now, Jesse Treichler, among other things, was the wife of the head of the drama department, Paul Treichler. But she was assistant to the president, and she had a knack. She went to a high school in Alabama, found a girl she thought could handle the Antioch curriculum, and induced her to sign up for Antioch. That was Edith Scott. Edith Scott did very well at Antioch. I remember having a discussion with her about communism in France. And then she recruited her younger sister, Coretta. Coretta majored in education. When the time came for her to do her practice teaching at the local school, she was refused because she was black. Yellow Springs still had a long way to go in 1946. So Coretta did her practice teaching at the Antioch School. She also had a music major, and she went from Antioch to the New England Conservatory to work on voice. In Boston, she met a seminary student by the name of Martin Luther King. And the rest is history. Anyhow, the Gandhian that I wanted to work with in New York was Bayard Rustin. I knew very little about him except that this is what he was doing. So I called him up. I explained my situation. He got me on the staff of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which he was employed by. And for 2 months, I worked for him essentially as his fetch and carry boy. What we did was to go to college campuses and give talks promoting integration. This happened to be just after Branch Rickey had hired Jackie Robinson for the Brooklyn Dodgers, which was a major event in race relations at that time. He was the first black to serve in professional baseball. Oh, thank you. It was a fast-moving experience. We would jump from campus to campus and stay in various sorts of lodging. You may be wondering how I dealt with the fact that Bayard was gay, particularly since while traveling, we shared a room and sometimes shared a bed. That's a reasonable question. My daughter, Laura, when she heard that I'd worked with Bayard, bright and bushy tail, she said, "Did you have a relationship?" Actually, I was totally blindsided by homosexuality. I knew nothing about it. I was totally unprepared for it. As it turned out, he made a couple of tentative passes at me, which I indicated I had no interest in, and so he respected that, and it didn't go any further. I was 19, and I was at the peak of my interest in girls at that particular time in life. One of them happened to be Lorena Esklow, with whom I had a significant interest. It was Christmas of 1947 when New York had a 27-inch snowfall. It wasn't a blizzard. The snow just kept coming down, and nothing moved on the streets of New York. So we would walk down the middle of the street and enjoy it. Our relationship began the previous year when I invited her for a date to a Vic concert. Now, a Vic concert was an Antioch tradition at that time. Somebody in one of the towers at the college campus would play a record on a phonograph and broadcast it out of the tower onto the campus. And students would come and sit on folding chairs or lie on a blanket and enjoy the music. And that was our first date. We had several subsequent dates. The formal dance in each division was called the Div Dance. And it was that was the event to take your date to. Now, neither of us was fond of dressing up, and that's been true for the rest of our lives. So I told her, "If you really want to go to the Div Dance, I'll take you." And she said, "Well, I don't really want to go, but I appreciate you're willing to take me." That relationship somehow seemed to cool when I went to medical school and we no longer saw each other. Then halfway through medical school, something happened. In retrospect, it's as if the Lord said to me, "You need to marry this girl." I thought, "Well, what if she says no?" The answer was, "She won't say no." And she didn't. It was the summer of 1950. If I was to do anything about it, I had to do it before classes resumed in September. So I wrote her where she was working in Chicago, and I said, "I'd like to come and visit you." She wrote back that she was sorry, but she was not going to be in Chicago through the summer. She planned to take a train to Denver to visit her mother, take another train to Albuquerque, where she would meet Wally and Juanita Melson, whom it's possible some of you may remember. They were active pacifists during and after World War II. And they were traveling through the Southwest and up the coast of California, visiting old friends in the pacifist movement. So she went to ride with them, stopped at the Hopi Reservation, the Hopis traditionally being pacifist, and the plan was for them to work their way north, stopping at various towns to see friends. One of the towns she mentioned was Tracy, California. So I got out a map and a calendar, and I sent her a wire. You remember wires? A telegram. And I said, I will meet you in Tracy on August 8th. That put me under a little pressure because there were only 4 days to get there. And this was before the days of interstates, and I was hitchhiking. The first night I got as far as St. Louis. The second day I had a ride to Columbia, Missouri, and after a wait there I was picked up by a businessman who was in a hurry. He drove and he drove and he drove. Drove all night and all day. Finally stopped off in Wendover and took a motel for about 4 hours and then drove on. We got to Sacramento on the 7th, and I called up my aunt, whom I knew lived there, and she invited me to come to her house and spend the night. And the next day, she kindly drove me to Tracy, and it was the 8th of August. My kids asked me, when did you propose to Mom? And somehow, after that adventure, proposing in words didn't seem quite necessary. We understood each other. So we started making plans to marry in the Cleveland meeting. She had been attending the 57th Street meeting in Chicago. But we wanted to get married over the Christmas holidays. She wound up her job in Chicago and moved to stay with some friends of ours in Cleveland until the actual marriage. We were working with our marriage committee to try to get it done during the Christmas holidays. The elder member of our marriage committee, Francis Bacon, said to us, friends do not do things in a hurry. But we managed to get done. We got married, and we were married for 64 years. One of my interests, which developed during my time at Antioch, was in intentional community. My first summer as a student at Antioch, I joined a dozen students who went to a place in North Dakota, farmed ourselves out to various jobs, and lived in a converted boxcar, which the owner had lent to us at no charge, with the idea that we would do some weeding in his corn. We did do some weeding in his corn, but he wasn't satisfied with how fast we worked, so he hired four Mexicans to come and really do the work. So we had lunch meeting with them and enjoyed their company, exchanging. We had one student who could speak Spanish, and she did well. So, as I say, the idea of intentional community was very attractive to me. We had heard about the Koinonia community in Georgia, so we went there to visit. That was an interesting visit. It was extremely hot. And that was terminated rather abruptly because Lorena began to get the pregnancy of, began to get the nausea of early pregnancy. We had agreed that we couldn't afford a baby, but on the other hand, we'd rather have a baby in a debt. So we decided to go ahead and have a baby. Here he is. Then back in Cleveland, back in medical school, I still had another year to go, two men arrived in Cleveland from the Bruderhof. The Bruderhof at that time was a spiritual community sharing all goods in common. And at that time, they were located in Paraguay. They'd originally started in Germany, had to leave Germany because of Hitler, moved to England, and had to leave England because they were Germans and pacifists and were not very popular in England during the war. But people kept joining them, so there, as it turned out, there was a community in England. Well, that was a lot closer to us than Paraguay, so we went to England to visit the community. I actually delayed internship in order to do this between medical school and internship. We stayed in the community for 3 months, and we even celebrated David's first birthday there. I found the community life very attractive. Lorena did not. She was eager to leave. She couldn't wait to get out of there. It was apparent that this was not the right thing for us. So we came back to the U.S. and I negotiated an internship in Detroit. That's where we had our second child. She's the only one of our family that isn't here. It took us a while in working through a marriage. We finally figured out that she and I had quite different gut reactions to groups. She enjoyed individual sociability, but participation in groups didn't work for her. Once we identified this difference in our makeups, we were able to allow for it, and it minimized the stress. I'm sure that most marriages find something like that in the course of events. The problem is to work it through. When I reached 18, I was disqualified from the draft and classified 4F because of a long history of asthma, which prevented me from taking sports in high school. When I completed my internship, the draft board was no longer interested in the asthma. They wanted me. They wanted doctors. I had already indicated to them that I was a conscientious objector. The local board turned me down as an objector, and I was faced with the possibility of prison. Fortunately, the Lord was with us, and the appeal officer accepted my position as a CO. So now, by this time, this was Korea, and the civilian public service program that had served during World War II had been dismantled. So it was a matter of finding some job that was acceptable to the selective service system as an alternative service. We wanted to live in Yellow Springs. I applied for a job at the Dayton State Hospital. The Dayton State Hospital in the middle 50s was the place where people with all sorts of mental illness would be housed, some of them for short periods and some of them for the rest of their lives. So there were about 1,800 people there, most of them elderly, most of them with a lot of the medical conditions that go with getting old. And I was the only doctor on the staff that wasn't a psychiatrist. So I got all the medical problems. Fortunately, I had consultants from Dayton and both medical and surgical to help me work through that. And I had a ball. It was as good as a medical residency. Finishing that, I hung out a shingle in Yellow Springs and started practicing medicine. And I moved from independent practice in Yellow Springs to a satisfactory medical partnership with Dr. Harry Burley, who had also been an Antioch graduate. Fast forward to the early 60s. By this time, I was established in medical practice. We had 4 children. And I looked around and I was concerned by the division that I saw between branches of friends. At that time, and I think still, there were 6 different yearly meetings represented in the state of Ohio. So I thought, what can we do about this? So I contacted people in Barnesville and people in Lake Erie, and we being in Ohio Valley, and also people in Indiana. We got representatives of those 4 meetings to meet together, and we had a series of meetings of representatives of the meetings, which were very spirit-filled and very helpful. And as things developed, we had we had 2 summer workshops or retreats using Quaker Haven, which was a retreat that really belonged to the Indiana yearly meeting. That was a satisfying time. I can't not say that anything came of that. There was no organic unity between these different branches of Friends, and I don't know that there ever will be, but at least we were talking to each other and getting acquainted with individuals. Back in the 1960s, Arthur Morgan, who, as you may know, revived Antioch College as an institution in 1920, lived in Yellow Springs and voiced the need that Yellow Springs had for a nursing home. That Yellow Springs should have a nursing home. It should be a nonprofit facility. Unfortunately, it didn't happen soon enough to serve his needs or those of his wife, Lucy. But in the late 70s, our member Paul Wagner gathered a group of friends in our meeting and set up a program. First, you hire a lawyer. Then you negotiate for a federal loan. Then you hire a builder and you put it up. And that's how Paul Wagner worked. And he did this on a number of occasions. And it happened. In 1980, we opened the nursing home in Yellow Springs. As it turned out, my father, who had been in a nursing home in Springfield, I moved him there, and he was the first resident of the Friends Care community in Yellow Springs. In opening it, it became clear that we needed a medical director, so I got the job of medical director, which I continued to serve until I retired. In 1977, I mentioned Douglas Steer. 1977, there was a gathering of friends of all branches, of Friends in the Americas, at Wichita. These were both pastoral and non-pastoral friends, a wide range of people who identified as friends. I took the opportunity to get in on that because, again, I was interested in cross relationships between the different branches of Friends. And that was a very, very exciting experience. Among other things, I was introduced to the charismatic renewal movement, which was affecting Friends, affecting other denominations. It also affected the Mennonite Church in Springfield, which at that time Sarah had discovered. She introduced me to it. I found the church spiritually rewarding, and for a number of years I sojourned as a Mennonite. Then in 2002, during the night, I experienced a clear leading. I had these leadings once in a while, not in actual words, but making it quite clear that this is what I needed to do. In this case, it was clear, Carl, you need to get back in active participation in the Friends meeting. Oh, okay. So I did. As it turned out, I learned that at that particular time, 2002, our meeting was in the kind of traumatic struggle that has gone on in other meetings and in denominations on the issue of same-sex marriage. Feelings were strong on both sides, even though no gay couple actually asked the meeting to marry them. So far, that hasn't happened. But we hassled that for about a year and finally agreed that we could keep the meeting from splitting. And I met with the most vocal persons on both sides. We finally said we would evaluate each couple, asking the usual questions to decide if the meeting could support this particular marriage, precisely what we do all the time anyway. And we apparently were satisfied with that, and peace was restored. In 1999, in Ohio, after a long period without executions, Ohio set an execution date. Again, the Spirit spoke to me and said, "Carl, you need to be there when this execution takes place." At that time, I had a camper van, so I contacted other people that I thought would be interested, friends, Mennonites, and a Catholic or two, and we drove to Lucasville, where the execution was scheduled to take place, and had a vigil outside the prison at that time. After the first episode, it became almost a routine. The state would set a date. I would recruit some people, and we would go to Lucasville and stand witness against execution. The last one I went to was in September of 2000, and times get away from me when you get old. 2013. There was one in January of 2014, which I didn't get to, and that was the last one we've had in Ohio. There were more executions scheduled in 2014. There have been they were rescheduled in 2015 because they didn't have the drugs. They still didn't have the drugs, so they were rescheduled in 2016 and again in 2017. So there are no executions scheduled in this year. But they still talk like they're going to do it if they can get the drugs. So one of the things that I did as time went on, I developed a practice of sending birthday cards to inmates on death row, and sometimes this would result in a continuing correspondence. I had quite a bit of correspondence with a number of people. One man in particular stands out. He was quite upfront about his crime. He said, I shot two men, and one of them was a cop. Then what happened, when he got to death row, the sister and mother of the cop sent him a letter saying, "Jesus tells us to forgive. We forgive you, even though you've deprived us of our son and brother." And they sent him a Bible with his name inscribed on it. He became a very enthusiastic Bible reader. He would chide me sometimes if he thought I was not sufficiently documented. He said, "Carl, are you born again?" And I'm not sure just how I answered that one. But his execution came up in September of 2013. And at that point, it's customary for the prisoner to contact the parole board and request clemency or whatever. He said, "I'm not asking for clemency. Jesus already gave me that." And as I say, he was the last execution that I attended. And there's only been this one since then, what was a badly botched one in January of 14. In 2015, it was apparent that Lorena, my wife, was not going to do well, and I put us both on the waiting list for assisted living at the Friends Community in Yellow Springs. Unfortunately, she didn't live long enough to take advantage of that, but I kept my name on the list, and when the opening came, I moved in. So I'm now living in assisted living. I've sold my house. And finally now a member of an intentional community. So I invite your comments or questions.
If you have questions, I have a microphone. If you'll stand, I'll bring it to you.
Hey, Sarah.
I'm sort of bragging on my dad. I have a very important compliment for him, having to do with mainly working as a physician at Dayton State. And also what he didn't mention was he considered psychiatry for a little while in medical school and ended up taking more psychiatric classes than is required for a doctor. I have schizoaffective disorder. I have a mental illness. And I believe very strongly that God meant for him to do what he did without even knowing the slightest idea his youngest daughter would be burdened with a mental illness. And he was very understanding. He was a religious Christian, but one I could trust. And I just wanted to mention that.
I wonder if any of the others of you have had any contact with Bayard Rustin. Bayard Rustin. He went on before I worked with him, he was on a ride in the Upper South to test the Supreme Court's ruling that you couldn't use discriminatory seating in interstate travel. And as a result, he wound up spending a month on a chain gang. After I knew him, he became the major organizer for the March on Washington, which was in what year? Yeah, 63, yeah. He was the one that made sure that the buses came in order to pick people up and to take them away again. He made sure there was enough food service and enough portable toilets, the kind of things that Martin Luther King didn't have to bother with. He could give the inspirational speech, but Bayard made sure that all things were taken care of.
Thank you so much for your wonderful witness. I wonder if you have anything to say to encourage young people who are considering a conscientious objection stance these days.
At this point, of course, there is no draft. And as long as that's true, I think it's not difficult to be a conscientious objector, because the only people that join the military are those who volunteer to do so. But that could change. We seem to be in a continuing series of wars, and an ex-president or a subsequent president could say, you know, we need to draft an army and fight this particular enemy that they happen to have at that particular time. And as you can recognize, if that happens, women will be drafted too. My advice would be to anybody who wants to take a conscientious objector position, be clear at the outset, if possible. If you know that's your position, make it clear when you start. Some people, and this was true of Bayard Rustin among others, will opt not to cooperate with the system at all, not to return mailings, and not to carry a draft card. Others will say, if they will classify me as a conscientious objector, I'll go along with the system, as long as they don't ask me to serve in the military. That's a choice any individual has to make. I mean, how far do we go in saying, I'm not going to be part of this system? It's an evil system. I don't want to be part of it. Does that answer your question?
Hi, Carl. You said there were several times where you felt you got a quote to simplify the statement, a message from God or a very strong leading. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about those experiences and how you experienced it. Was there a verbal connection, body sensations, those types of things for those of us who have had them and for those who wonder if they've had them?
Yeah. No, I can't say it was actually verbal. I didn't hear a voice. Most of the occasions, in my recollection, came in the middle of the night. I would be lying awake and seemingly suddenly, maybe it wasn't sudden, but it seemed sudden, I would get this clear indication that now is the time to do such and such. It would not be something that I hadn't considered before, but it would be a clear indication that this is what I need to do.
That felt within the body is where you kind of felt that?
I'm not sure how to answer that. It was in my thinking, and I don't think I had any particular body sensations.
There was a lady in my former Lutheran church, and maybe this would simplify it because I think of it this way. I think my dad had experienced a feeling he was nudged to do it. Just all together, he felt a nudging to
do it.
Word.
Anyway, thank you for your inspiration and for your faithful service. I'm wondering two things. One is, did you know Ernest and Marion Bromley and the Brokaws? Because you mentioned the peacemakers. Because they knew Wally and Juanita Nelson. I just figured everyone knew each other then.
Well, I was one of those that knew all those people.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then I'm wondering which part of Quakerism speaks to you the most these days? That's a hard question, I know.
Yeah. Well, I am a Christian, although I recognize that not all people in the Friends Society are Christian, and not all people in my meeting are Christian. And that's okay. I don't have a problem with that. But this is how I am led. Can you give me your question again? I'm not sure I'm answering it.
Well, given you're a Christian within the Quaker tradition, what part of Quakerism speaks to you the most? Any particular part these days speak to you the most?
I'm not sure that it speaks to me more than any other part of Quakerism, but I'm sure moved by the direct action, when friends take direct action, as in the case of the recent change of policy of the bank that was financing mountaintop removal. I think that's good, but I think the most important part of Quakerism is the day-to-day service. There's a story of a stranger that came to a friend's meeting and it settled into silence, and he nudged the next person to him and said, "When does the service begin?" And the man said, "The service begins after the worship is over." Yeah. And there's a sense that a lot of friends have, I think most friends have this, that we need to be doing something to make this a better world. And I can relate to that.
Hi, Carl. World War II was considered a sort of a popular war among the culture. Everybody seemed to jump on board and support it. I know my uncle served in it and came back really messed up psychologically and emotionally from the scars of the war that I saw the rest of my life. And I just wondered how you coped with that, being a conscientious objector of World War II, because that was not a popular stance for that war at all. It's for people that were objected to it and didn't want to serve in it.
Well, as it happened, I didn't really have to make that decision until the war was essentially over. Earlier, it might have been more difficult. I spoke at our meeting just a week or two ago. We had a hymn that we sang, "Peace in Our Time," is the title of the hymn. Those words, the words of that hymn, were written in 1938. In 1938, the British representative, the French representative, names escaped me, the man with the umbrella. The British representative negotiated with Hitler.
Chamberlain,
thank you. Chamberlain said, we'll let you have the Sudetenland because you complain that the Germans are being discriminated against, and we won't go to war. And Hitler said, okay, I'll be satisfied with that. And of course, the first thing he did was to take the entire country of Czechoslovakia. A year later, he invaded Poland. 2 years later, he invaded France and the Low Countries, Denmark, and Norway. And 3 years later, he was bombing London. Well, that's a difficult time for a pacifist, which is exactly your point, I think. It's hard to defend the peace position with Hitler. I think people like Bayard Rustin did that. I mean, he was determined to stand firm as a pacifist no matter what, and he spent the war in prison. I think it's essential for anybody who wants to be a CO to be able to work through that conflict. In other words, are we dealing with a real threat to our country, a real madman that can can do terrible things. And do we need to consent to make war in order to stop that? And if as Quakers we say, as George Fox did say in 1660, under no circumstances, either for the kingdoms of this world or the kingdoms of Christ, we will not go to war. And the only way, I think, to be clear is to stick to that, no matter what the external circumstances. My father told me that he was a pacifist, and he developed his pacifism when this country was sending Marines into Nicaragua. He was not prepared for Hitler.
I'm interested in your interest in intentional community. I'm actually a part of an intentional community of three families and have been for about 15 years. And of course, we have difficulties we have to work through. So I guess my question is, can you expand a little bit on what is your interest, what has been your interest, and how do you see intentional community as an alternative solution for society?
It seemed to me that that community is the way people should live. Not everybody feels that way. But it seems to me that that human beings are meant to live together in groups. Our society is not structured that way. The so-called American dream is the individual house on an individual lot in a suburb, necessitating driving to work. And I think this is not only destructive to the environment, but it's not really healthy for people. I don't know if that relates to your experience. The fact is, as I found out, that not everybody can handle group living. It doesn't work for everybody. It didn't work for Lorena. Thank you all for coming. I'm glad to have a chance to talk about myself. And I hope it was of some interest.